Kate Wilcox here for the Centre for Public Christianity, and today I'm talking to Judy Steele, who has just released her autobiography, Mama Jude. This book tells of her extraordinary work as a nurse in the slums of Uganda. Thanks for speaking with us, Judy.
My pleasure, Kate.
Judy, you worked as a nurse in Australian hospitals for over 30 years. Uh-huh. And when you planned your retirement, you write you looked forward to spending time with your family and developing some hobbies, but that you certainly weren't going to be a volunteer. And yet you
went.
And yet you ended up working in hospitals in Uganda and co-founding the Uganda Australian Christian Outreach. What was it that made you revise your retirement plans?
Well, I think it was God that fixed my retirement plan, not me. But my husband and I were travelling in the outback, and we got stuck in the outback. Even though we had checked that there would be no rain, we were driving from Adelaide to Townsville in a straight line virtually, and we were north of Inaminka, north of on the Stradbeckie track, and God in his infinite wisdom gave us 6 inches of rain in about 2 hours. There we stayed for a week. Now at the start it was very scary, and even though we had food and water and all those sorts of things, we did lose weight, and I'm scared. But then we got over that, and I sort of said to my husband, you know, I've got this picture in my head of me holding a black baby and being surrounded by black children. And he said, well, you better go and speak to our minister when you get home about that. And I said, oh, okay, you know, because I wasn't really hugely practicing Christian. I went to church and all that sort of thing, but I just was, you know, I guess looking for something else. And anyway, we finally got rescued and we came home on the bitumen. No more off-road driving for me. And I went to see my minister, and that started my spiritual journey. He was a wonderful man called Gillis Ambler, minister of our Uniting Church. And he guided me into looking deep within myself to see what it was that I wanted to do. And I thought, well, you know, I've just got to follow this journey. I have to go and find this baby and these children. And I gave up a really good job. I was director of care of Rest Haven in Adelaide, which was a very large organisation. I was 57 years old. And 6 months later, I had done some very limited but very important training. I went to Uganda. I just kept feeling all the time, I have to be obedient here. And when I was in Uganda that very first year, I was working in a slum, and I have the photo, and it's in the book, of me holding a baby in my arms, and I was surrounded by at least 200 black kids at the time, and I just wept. I mean, it was very powerful.
And it's certainly powerfully told in your book. Can you tell us about the nature of the work that you have been doing in Uganda?
Sure. You know, God's a bit sneaky at times. He only reveals things to you a bit at a time. And that's very good, because I would have said right at the start, I can't do this. This is too big. You go and go know someone else that's got more skills than I have. But when I look back over my life, God was actually training me every year of my professional career to do things and to be able to do what I do now in Uganda. So I went out there and I just worked in the slums in a clinic, taking care of people, working alongside Ugandans. I was learning a bit of the language, I was learning the culture, and I was certainly learning how to do things the Ugandan way. I had to let go of all my Aussie ideas, because it's all done differently out there. And while I was there, I met this beautiful doctor, Ugandan doctor Edward Sambatia, and he suggested that I come and visit him in his little hospital, which was 8 beds, 24-hour facility, simple, basic, really first aid stuff. And so I went between the two slums. But after 2 years, going out for 2 years and working in the first slum in Nakulawia, I had finished what I call my apprenticeship. I had to walk away, which is a big lesson if you're a medical missionary, and when you realise that you can't save them all, and you can't always make that difference, because I had to deal with bias and corruption and all that sort of thing. I think they saw me as, you know, the white Mzungu, you know, the white person that was going to make everything different for them, but I was used and cheated too. And although I still visit the woman that I worked with out there and I love her, I had to walk away from it. And Edward said, why don't you come and work with me, which I did. And so slowly, you know, we developed this beautiful relationship. I'm really his sister. His wife is my sister. And I'm grandmother to all their kids, sort of thing. And slowly we thought, we need to develop this community care here. I came home from that second trip to find that Rest Haven, my employer, was offering me some equipment. During this time, Edward was building a new hospital right next to his old one. It was 30 beds. But, you know, my minister, Reverend Gillis Ambler, he called him the Noah of Najinankumbi because he was following God's call, but he didn't know how he was going to ever equip this hospital. Mm-hmm. But he built it. He had the shell. And I came along and said, well, look, I'm going to bring out a container and I've got enough equipment to completely equip your hospital. And 7:30 report in Adelaide picked up that story. It went round Australia and people donated some money, which enabled me to get it out there because I didn't have enough. And we had enough left over to finish building the hospital. Because the shell was there, but it didn't have plumbing or flight screens or electricity or a generator and all those things.
Now, some of those stories in the book are pretty confronting. What were the hardest things that you encountered during your time in Uganda?
That's a good question. Even now, I find abuse confronting. And that starts from the time a child is born till the day they die. I am totally challenged when I see tiny children being sat in the mud to beg and the father or the mother is standing off some distance and watching, and I just want to pick those babies up and run with them, but I can't change that. And quite often I might be in a bus going by, so I just have to pray about that because it breaks my heart. Another time I will go and I will see an older person, particularly an older woman who is being abused, who's not being taken care of. And I sometimes have to do what I call my Jesus in the temple thing, when he turned over the tables of the money changers, and I have to, I call it my righteous anger, and I have to do something to change that. And that usually involves sitting down with the village leaders, talking with my friend Dr. Edward, and he says to me quite often, he has a laugh, he says, I knew you'd be mad about this. And so we have to do something that will change that. We can't perform miracles, but we can change people's quality of life. And that might just mean somebody has been sleeping on cardboard because they're a paraplegic and they can't climb up into a bed if they had one. So I can get a carpenter to build a bed that's only 6 inches off the floor, and they can get into that for that. That's huge quality of life for them. Yeah, I have indelible memories of things like this. They'll be with me till the day I die.
When looking at a country like Uganda and when reading the book, it can be easy to get overwhelmed by the suffering there. But you say in your book that Uganda showed you the heights and depths of humanity. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about some of the heights of humanity that you're able to witness?
They give me far more than I have ever given them. You know, they love absolutely unconditionally. And they love Jesus, you see. They'll come up to me and they say, you saved? I can be walking up the street in Kampala and someone say, you saved? And I have great delight in telling them I am. But you know, they have been through dreadful times with Idi Amin and Obote, and all they had was Jesus. And that's what they have taught me, you know. Some of my friends say to me, oh, would you pray for such and such? You've got a direct line to God. I say, come on, we've all got a direct line to God. You just have to expect him to answer. You know, because that's one of the things they've taught me. God answers all your prayers. They just love, and they've taught. I mean, I am a very sort of tactile, loving person, and it's just, I'm just an extension of their families now. I've got thousands of little black grandchildren out there, and I think there's a lot of little Judys running around out there. You know, I spoke to a friend of mine one day. Her name is Jane. Her husband was murdered in Tanzania, and she didn't find out he was dead for 6 months. And she had three kids, and one of them was only 6 months old. And I said to her, Jane, how do you manage? You know, she can't send her children to school. I said, how do you feed your children? And she just looked at me and smiled, and she said, oh, I just trust God. And I thought, there's another lesson for Judy, you know, the simple, wonderful spirituality of Africa.
That's wonderful. Mm. Now, perhaps on a bit of a lighter note, but apart from family and friends, what was it that you missed most about Australia?
I miss talking to my kids. My kids live around the world, but, you know, out there I can't afford to ring out. I mean, it's just too expensive. But, you know, we do have emails now, and that's superb. You know, somebody gave me a laptop, and that is just wonderful. I have total frustration with the electricity and the internet cafes where I have to go to send them, but, you know, that's all right. At least once a week I can email home to my husband and my kids. I miss simple things like meat, lamb, because out there, if you go to the butcher, which is just like a roadside stall, the meat comes in at daybreak, and that's a good time to buy it, because there's no such thing as like a kilo of rump. They just start at one end of the beef, and you get a kilo of meat. So everything needs to be boiled, you know, for a few hours to make sure everything's clean. Fruit and veggies out there are fantastic because it's all tropical, and I live on pineapples and avocados and bananas and things like that. It's fantastic. I miss cheese because I can't afford to buy it out there. It's all imported and it's just too dear. I take a kilogram in my suitcase when I leave, but it doesn't last for a couple of months, obviously. I take my Vegemite, and anyone that comes out has to BYO Vegemite. And if they bring Tim Tams, that's a good idea. So, you know, you have to lighten up. When I'm working at the hospital, Edward's wife, Rose, she feeds me every day. So I don't need, like, a big supper at night and things like that. So what else is the lighten up thing? I'm trying to think. I think the joy, the infectious laughter, I tell you something, going to church in Uganda is the most wonderful experience. I mean, I've learnt now to get there about 20 minutes early, because by then there's about 500 people waiting out the front for the next service, and I've learned how to wriggle through to the front and get near the door when it opens, because when it opens you've got to just about run into church to get a seat. I've got it down to a fine art. What I don't like doing is not being able to get inside the church, and you have to go to the overflow and watch it on TV. And for me, I need to be inside the church. You know, that's where I feel the power of God and the Holy Spirit most.
Now, just one final question. Your book offers no overt call to action at the end, no preacher's altar call, if you like, asking people to come to your Uganda. Is that the aim of the book, to get more people involved in charitable work? Or in your mind, what would be the ideal outcome of someone reading your book?
The ideal outcome is that I raise enough money to build an operating theatre. If you think back to the story of giving someone a fish or giving someone a fishing rod, okay, if you give them the fish, they only eat for a day. If you give them the fishing rod, they eat for life. We have always focused on self-sufficiency and not handouts. Because this organisation is very big now, and we have many different facets to the clinic. It's not just a medical clinic. It's a literacy class, small loan scheme, HIV/AIDS support group, a walking clinic into the slums. But if I can build an operating theatre out there, Edward has told me that he doesn't need all the money that he will make from people who can afford to pay for surgery. He will put back a large percentage to run UACO. By then, they will continue to have the free clinic for the poorest of the poor, the free ambulance for the poorest of the poor, the free physiotherapy for the poorest of the poor. And we will be able to withdraw and say, this is your fishing rod. This is how you will now manage it yourself. I have, don't misunderstand me, I have Aussies coming out with me for the last two trips, and I have six or seven organised for next year, but that's as many as I can cope with. You know, I have to be the team leader, and that's full time for me.
Well, Judy, thanks so much for talking with us today.
It's been my absolute pleasure. Thanks, Kate.